All right, so we're diving into the real crazy looking stuff that the Book of Revelation has to offer. We're going to be dealing with the seven seals, primarily the first four that are laid out there. And we'll see how far we get, as is always the caveat, because the approach that we're going to take through the Book of Revelation is we're going to go back through the scripture when it makes a reference of something, and we're going to examine what it has to say in other places, because that's going to help set the definition and the tone for what the book's going to be talking about for us. Again, it leans heavily on things that have already been discussed throughout the scriptures, a lot of Old Testament imagery. So we're going to go back through and look at a lot of these things and see how they're used. That way, when we get to the Book of Revelation, those definitions are already defined and we will understand them in that capacity. Okay. There, again, Revelation is the last book and it leans heavily on definitions that have already been established. So today, though, we're dealing with the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Wasn't there like a wrestling team in WWE or Okay, all right. Yeah, those are the ones I remember, is the ones that were in. Okay, anyway, it's all fake. Four horsemen, it's all fake. No, but these are the real ones. These are the real guys, right? So the four horsemen of the apocalypse in Revelation, they're the real ones. Now, what's interesting is that these aren't the first time, or this isn't the first time. Let me get my verb and noun agreement together here. This isn't the first time that we see horses in the scripture that God uses for judgment. We actually see them quite a few times, and we're going to go back and check out a few of these, because like I've found throughout the whole book, man, is there some cool stuff in here, especially when you go back and see the richness of the passages that use these types of things beforehand. So we're going to start off with verse 1, and we're going to read all the way through to verse number 8. It says, "Then I saw when the Lamb broke one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying, as with the voice of thunder, come. I looked, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. When he broke the second seal, I heard a second living creature saying, come. And another, a red horse, went out, and to him who sat on it, it was granted to take peace from the earth, and that men would slay one another, and a great sword was given to him. When he broke the third seal, I heard a third living creature saying, come. I looked, and behold, a black horse, and he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hands, or in his hand. And I heard something like a voice in the center of the four living creatures saying, a quart of wheat for a denarius and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not damage the oil and the wine. When the Lamb broke the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature saying, come. I looked, and behold, an ashen horse, and he who sat on it had the name Death, and Hades was following with him. Authority was given to them over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword and with famine and with pestilence and by the wild beasts of the earth." Now, if you happen to see anything, you know, online or on TV or a podcast dealing with the far out dispensational ideas, you'll find all kinds of crazy theories around these types of things. And what's really interesting is that a lot of these don't go by anything except the modern headlines. Because as you know, John wrote the book of Revelation for us in our time to be interpreted by the news. All right? Which channel? That's a good... That's a good question, Phil. Jesus didn't state, although maybe someone's going to get a revelation to state which channel. It's probably Fox News, would be my guess, because that's, what's that name? It could be Al Jazeera. Yeah, it could be. Or the Jerusalem Post, probably, you know, because the Jews are still the chosen people, so the Jerusalem Post should be the, anyway. I love those AI reels online where, you know, it's Jesus talking to the people of that time. And he's like, so, you know, when are these things to take place? And it's like, that's for Greg watching Fox News 2000 years from now, right? It's pretty funny because it's how everybody interprets things, right? I mean, think about it. What would have happened if you would have been living in, say, let's say you're a dispensationalist and you're living in 1939? What would you think at that particular time? The whole world's coming to an end, right? I mean, but you'd have a problem, you know, Israel's not a nation yet. So now 1948 comes and the Korean War in the early 50s is starting to come around. Now Israel's a nation, all the blocks, the obstacles are gone. Now you're thinking, oh no, the whole world's gonna get tumbled into war and the Antichrist. See what I mean? Everybody in every generation is going to think this. What if you were alive during the Cuban Missile Crisis and interpreting all this stuff through the lens of the Cuban Missile Crisis and we're all about to blow each other up? See what I mean? It's like everything is why are you texting me? I'm just kidding. Okay, thanks. It's like, huh, Brian's texting me. Oh, excellent, excellent. Okay, he sends me a picture of the four horsemen running through. Okay, I will. It's too small on my little watch here. So everybody thinks it's in their time frame. The point is, you can't interpret this through the news. You really can't, especially the seals. The seals are so general. They're so vague. They're so nonspecific. It's like God's trying to tell us, don't try to figure out a specific date or time on these. They're very general. I mean, what we just read, you know, he went out to conquer. A crown was given to him. Doesn't say nothing about it is listed, right? Then we've got the red horse. Take peace from the earth so that men can slay one another. Is there anything in that that lets you know when that's going to be? Because obviously people don't kill each other, right? This is just a modern phenomena. You understand where I'm going with this? You can't look at this from a specific time frame and say, and point to a specific event and say, ah, this is it. Or just to a couple of series of events and say, ah, this is it. Especially not with the seals. Okay. Now he does get more specific as we go along, but even then, We'll look at those as we come to them. So what we're going to do is we're going to go back through the scripture and we're going to look at some of these things on the horses, the four horse or the different horses that God uses, the colors of them, what they represent as we move forward today. So let's go back to Zechariah chapter 1. The concept of the horses really comes out in the book of Zechariah. So Zechariah chapter 1, verse 7, and it says, on the 24th day of the 11th month, which is the month of Shabbat, in the second year of Darius. Now, in case you want to know what the actual date is, that's February 24th, 519 BC, just in case you were interested. The word of the Lord came to Zechariah the prophet, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo, as follows. I saw at night, and behold, a man was riding on a red horse, and he was standing among the myrtle trees, which were in the ravine, with red, sorrel, and white horses behind him. Then I said, my Lord, what are these? And the angel who was speaking with me said to me, I will show you what these are. And the man who was standing among the myrtle trees answered and said, "These are those whom the Lord has sent to patrol the earth." So they answered the angel of the Lord who was standing among the myrtle trees and said, "We have patrolled the earth, and behold, all the earth is peaceful and quiet." Then the angel of the Lord said, "O Lord of hosts, how long will you have no compassion for Jerusalem and the cities of Judah, with which you have been indignant these 70 years? The Lord answered the angel who was speaking with me with gracious words, comforting words. So the angel who was speaking with me said to them, proclaim, saying, thus says Lord of hosts, I am exceedingly jealous for Jerusalem and Zion. But I am very angry with the nations who are at ease. For while I was only a little angry, they furthered the disaster. Therefore, thus says the Lord, I will return to Jerusalem with compassion. My house will be built in it, declares the Lord of hosts, and a measuring line will be stretched over Jerusalem." So I'm going to stop there. So here's what we see. We see four horses. The first one is a red horse. We don't really know if there's any symbolism with any of these horses in this particular passage because the colors aren't really said to mean anything. All right. And then you go through a little bit further and you have three other horses, red, sorrel, and white. So it looks like there's two red horses, which is interesting. But you have the first red horse and there's a man on it, and that man is given a title. What's the title he's given? Can anybody see in there? Yeah, angel of the Lord. Right? So look at verse number 11. So they answered the angel of the Lord who was standing among the myrtle trees. That's the guy on the red horse. Now, one of the things that we know from the Old Testament is the angel of the Lord is a pre-incarnate theophany of Jesus Christ, because he is constantly called Yahweh all throughout the Old Testament. He receives submission or worship. He is called Yahweh several times. And so anytime you see that the angel of the Lord, that is a pre-incarnate theophany of Jesus Christ. And you can, a good study for you would be, if you have any questions about that, go and look up every single time that term, the angel of the Lord, appears and read that in context. And you'll make that determination probably for yourself. So the angel of the Lord gets a report back from these three other guys. Now, again, these three other angels that are on these, and that's probably what they are, and we're going to get more into the definition of who these guys are, because they're also, the four horsemen are also called other terms that we'll see here in a second. Not in Zechariah 1, but in another passage in Zechariah. And then we're going to do, when we get to Revelation 7, we're going to do a breakout special study on these different things that I'll tell you about in a moment. So we have red, sorrel, and white. So red, typically when we see it defined, means war, like it does in Revelation 6. The red horse, maybe not war necessarily, but definitely no peace, killing, death, is what is taking place with these red horses. All right. And you don't have to use too much imagery to figure out why. White symbolizes purity and victory. We see that in Revelation chapter 6, because you have the one who sits upon the white horse, a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering, a bow also, and he went out conquering. The concept of the bow is really interesting that we'll dive into, because there's two messianic prophecies that deal with this in this specific context. Super cool. When you start pulling back the layers of the onions on these things, it's a big onion. And there's lots of layers. And it's pretty amazing. So sorrel, that word sorrel, well, what do other versions have instead of sorrel there for verse number 8? You got red, white. What's the middle one for sorrel? Sorrel? Brown. Okay. So sorrel's the best guess. Now, the root word comes from using vines, possibly grapes, like a choice vine. So it's probably like a reddish, possibly a brown color. But so sorrel has this concept of being splotchy, right? Multicolors. And you're like, well, where are they getting that from this Hebrew word? They're not getting it from the Hebrew word. The Septuagint translators, remember the Greek translation of the Old Testament that was made before the time of Christ. It's the Bible that the Hellenistic Jews like Paul would have used. All right. That word is poikiloi, and that means variegated or spotted. Okay. So that's where they got that concept from, is from the Greek translation, because the concept would be, who would probably know more about what this word was used for at that time than the Septuagint translators who translated it just a couple hundred years after Zechariah wrote this. So they put a lot of weight on that. So that's why they think this is a spotted one. Now, what's interesting, it kind of don't matter. I'm just bringing it out for academic purposes. This word is what's called a hapax legomena. It's only used once in the Bible, and it's right here, and it's never used again. Now, I bring this up because, well, I guess it's more than academic. I bring this up because when we get to Zechariah 6, it is going to matter a little bit. So, the rider on the red horse, like I mentioned, is viewed as the angel of the Lord, pre-incarnate version of Christ. And he commands and controls the other riders. They report to him. He's the boss. And if that is a pre-incarnate version of Christ, which it probably is, that makes sense. He's the boss on the field, right? Everyone's going to report to him. Now, notice what these other horses were doing. They were patrolling the earth, single horses, single riders. That's going to become important in a second too. Patrolling the earth. And what was their report back to the angel of the Lord? It's all quiet. Peace and quiet. Now, you would think that's a good report. You know, if the report came back today as to what's going on, probably wouldn't say that, right? At least definitely not how things have been. So, peace and quiet sounds good. But look at what the angel of the Lord says in verse 12. Then the angel of the Lord said, O Lord of hosts, how long will you have no compassion for Jerusalem and the cities of Judah with which you have been indignant for these 70 years? So basically, the angel of the Lord saying, peace and quiet's no good. It's time for Jerusalem to be restored. Now, this is obviously referring back to the time of destruction that took place. And he's making the point, these nations, specifically the nation of the north, Babylon, did this, and they need to be held accountable. Because if you look at verse 15, he says, but I am very angry with the nations who are at ease, for while I was only a little angry, they furthered the disaster. Now, here's the interesting part. God stirred up the Chaldeans, but the Chaldeans didn't listen to the extent that God wanted things to be done. And them and their free will went much further than what God wanted to have done. So God ends up stirring up another nation, the Persians, to inflict judgment upon them. Okay, so this is how God works. So one of the most, in God's dealings with mankind, there are a lot of things that God put in place. There is one absolutely sacred thing that the sovereign God put in place that he will not violate. He will not violate the free will of human beings. He will strengthen the free will of human beings, but he will not violate the free will of human beings. Because God's ability to be just is completely tied to his ability of man's ability to have a free will and be able to be held accountable for everything that they do. So you see, this is why I really dislike Calvinism so much, because it doesn't just impact how we view ourselves, but it really directly relates back to God and his justice. And it puts the blame squarely on God for imputing unrighteousness to people, causing them to be born in a way that they have no control over, and then judging them eternally for it. That's why Calvinism is so evil. It goes back and makes a mockery of God's justice, his character. So God will not violate free will. And so he makes the point, these nations went further than what I wanted them to, and therefore I'm going to judge them. So here's what we see so far, and we're going to build on this. These single horses, different colors. Now notice we see red, sorrel, and white. We don't see black, right? So again, we'll see that in a second. But what they're doing is they're patrolling. They're gathering information. Does God need to gather information? Does he need reconnaissance patrols on the earth? No. There's a reason why this is being done like this. Let's go to Zechariah 6 and find out. You see, visions are connected. Look at verse 1. It says, now it lifted up my eyes again, and looked and behold, four chariots were coming forth from between the two mountains. A ravine is between two mountains, or at least outcroppings. So we'll see this. Coming from between the two mountains, and the mountains were bronze mountains. So this lets us know we're not talking about a physical location. I don't know of any, you know, bronze mountains that are out there. This is more than likely the heavenly Jerusalem. All right, more than likely. But we'll, you know, I don't know if we'll discuss that later, but you can put in your notes Joel 3:12, same kind of concept, the Valley of Jehoshaphat, where the final judgment's going to take place, same kind of concept. So, verse 2. With the first chariot were red horses, the second chariot black horses, the third chariot white horses, and with the fourth chariot strong dappled horses. So the dappled is going to be the same as the sorrel, but it's a different word that's being used there. So I think what Zechariah is doing is he is describing in a different word what that first sorrel horse was. But now another horse gets added, the black horse. And now what we see is almost is the key, a direct correlation between these horses and the ones in Revelation 6. Red, white, black, and sorrel, which would be the pale ashen horse that we'll see in a second. All right, verse 4. Then I spoke and said to the angel who was speaking with me, what are these, my Lord? The angel replied to me, these are the four spirits of heaven going forth after standing before the Lord of all the earth, with one of which the black horses are going forth to the north country, and the white one goes forth after them, while the dappled one goes forth to the south country. So, what title are these four chariots with horses given? Yeah, more specifically than the spirits of heaven. There's a number. Four spirits of heaven. So also, what? And does any of you not have four there? Okay, got it. Four. See, that's the thing. Jeremiah says, ESV says four winds. These can be translated both ways. The Hebrew word can be translated spirits or winds. And what you'll find is that all through the Bible, you'll see this concept called the four winds or the four spirits. But then you also see, and here they're called the four winds of heaven or four spirits of heaven. But then you see something else throughout the scripture called the seven spirits of God. And so what we're going to do is we're going to do a study and show what, you know, who these are, what their job is, and when they're used. It's actually a really cool, interesting study. But we won't get to that till we get to chapter 7, verse 1, because that's when we first see the four winds in Revelation. All right. Sometimes it looks like they're inanimate, but when you dig, when you pull the curtain back a little bit, you'll see that these four winds or four spirits are actually the movement of God through more than likely specific angels in the history of mankind. In other words, what is it that that wind does? It stirs things up. Because remember, what is the world viewed as in the book of Revelation? Sea of glass. What happens when you get a mighty heavenly wind blowing on a, or a mighty wind blowing on a body of water? Waves, turmoil, erosion, destruction. All this stuff's connected, guys. It's really interesting. It's really interesting. And so recognize that behind the curtain of all the stuff that goes on is the permissive and sometimes express will of God making stuff happen. Because in this particular case, God wasn't interested in the earth being at rest. Judgment needed to take place. All right, so we'll see. Now notice, you know, Zechariah asks in verse 4, "What are these, my Lord?" Verse 5, "The angel replied to me, 'These are the four spirits of heaven going forth after standing before the Lord of all the earth, with one of which the black horses are going forth to the north country.'" That's Babylon. Those are the people that God wanted judged back in chapter 1. Now they're going after them. And then the white horse goes after them. So we've got death and then we've got conquering that's going to take place. Righteous judgment. Okay. Then we've got the, it says, "While the dappled ones go forth to the south country." So there's people in the south that needed to be taken care of. And what happened there, when Babylon was destroying Jerusalem and Judah, a lot of the side countries to the south got involved as well. Like Edom was a big one. They got involved with the destruction. So, you know, they're, the enemies of Israel rejoiced and participated. So God's going to, you know, dish it out to them too. All right. Now, what I find interesting is this. You've got the patrol happening first, and then you've got the judgment happening second. Now, here's my take on this. What this does is that it's showing humanity that God is not arbitrary in his judgment, but he's using our concepts to teach us this. God investigates and then judges. In other words, he knows what's going on before he judges. He's not some crazy deity sitting in wherever he would sit and just gets a whim and says, "I'm just going to destroy these people," and not knowing what's going on. That happened in the mythology of the nations all the time. These gods were not all-knowing. They made mistakes. They were the worst of humanity. They were made in the image of people, and they were the worst of humanity. What we see here is God is saying, "I'm not like thee. I'm not, when I judge, when I send forth judgment upon the earth, it's only after careful investigation." In other words, I know what I'm doing. I don't want to do this. I do it because I have to. God's judgments are thorough. They are not impulsive nor haphazard. And when he judges purposefully. Now, if you go down a little bit further, he says in verse 7, "When the strong ones went out, they were eager to patrol the earth. He said to them, 'Go patrol the earth.' So they patrolled the earth. Then he cried out to me and spoke, saying, 'See, those who are going to the land of the north, they have appeased my wrath in the land of the north.'" So the single horses go out to patrol, and then he sends out the chariots. You're not sending out the chariots to patrol. The chariots are designed to execute the judgment. All right. So this is the picture that God is using in Zechariah. And notice we've got white, red, black, and the dappled one. Strong. And they're all strong horses as well. All right, now we're going to go to a couple of other passages. But anybody got any questions on this so far? I know it's just kind of hanging out there a little bit. We'll bring it together here in a little bit. All right, let's go to 2 Kings chapter 2. Second Kings chapter 2, verse 9. Elijah and Elisha. It says, when they had crossed over, Elijah said to Elisha, ask what I shall do for you before I am taken from you. And Elisha said, please let a double portion of your spirit be upon me. He said, you have asked a hard thing. Nevertheless, if you see me when I am taken from you, it shall be so for you. But if not, it shall not be so. As they were going along and talking, behold, there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire, which separated the two of them. And Elijah went up by a whirlwind to heaven. Now, this is a little bit different because we're not talking about a red, a white, a black, or a dappled one, but we're talking about a chariot of fire, right? Now, so the question is, who are these what's this chariot of fire? Because we see one of them. Now, this is interesting. Elijah is a type of John the Baptist. Elisha, then, would have been a type of Christ. And Elisha is the only guy that I'm aware of, outside of Jesus Christ, when you come in, when a dead person came in contact with the dead body of Elisha, what happened? He resurrected. Now, you can think about that a little bit, but that's pretty interesting. Okay. So Elisha wanted a double portion of the Spirit. So let's see how that manifests itself. Let's go to chapter 6. Remember the Arameans, how they plotted to capture Elisha? And they came to Dothan and, you know, they were surrounded by the Arameans. And Elisha's servant was a little nervous. Verse 15. He says, this is 2 Kings 6. It says, now when the attendant of the man of God had risen early and gone out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was circling the city. And his servant said to him, alas, my master, what shall we do? So he answered, do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them. Then Elisha prayed and said, O Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see. And the Lord opened the servant's eyes and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. Elijah had one chariot come and get him. Elisha had at his disposal the armies of heaven. That's the difference between John and Jesus. That's the difference between someone under the old covenant and someone under the new covenant. I can't think of a more stark difference between that. Both are great. One's far greater. I just think that's really interesting. But notice how God does this with horses. Let's go back to let's go to Psalm 68. We'll go in order here. Psalm 68, verse 15. It says, the mountain of God is the mountain of Bashan. A mountain of many peaks is the mountain of Bashan. Why do you look with envy, O mountains with many peaks, at the mountain of God, the mountain which God has desired for his abode? Surely the Lord will dwell there forever. The chariots of God are myriads, thousands upon thousands. The Lord is among them as at Sinai in holiness. And we think, okay, well, this is cool. This is great. He's letting us know that God's chariots are thousands times thousands, you know, 10,000 times 10,000s. That's a lot. You know, get out your calculator. What's the context, though? Verse 18. You have ascended on high. You have led captive your captives. You have received gifts among men, even among the rebellious also, that the Lord may dwell there. What's that talking about? Where's that verse quoted? Ephesians 4. And as we start diving more into the mystery, we're going to go through essentially the whole book of Ephesians and Colossians at a high level and show this passage is one of the passages mentioned there. Is talking about something really amazing that God has done, all centered around the eternal purpose of God. In other words, he's letting us know the power that is behind the victory that he's won. So God uses this imagery. All right, let's go to Habakkuk chapter 3. One of my favorite passages. Habakkuk chapter 3. And let's look at verse 8. And we're going to read through verse 15. Did the Lord rage against the rivers? Or was your anger against the rivers? Or was your wrath against the sea? That you rode on your horses, on your chariots of salvation. Your bow was made bare. The rods of chastisement were sworn. You cleaved the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you and quaked. The downpour of water swept by. The deep uttered forth its voice. It lifted high its hands. The sun and moon stood in their places and went away at the light of your arrows, at the radiance of your gleaming spear. Man, this sounds pretty epic, doesn't it? And so you're wondering, he's drawing on a few different types of imagery, isn't he? He's looking at chariots. He's almost using a creation motif. You know, that he cleaved the earth with rivers. The mountains quaking. Downpours of water. And then he's bringing up the concept or alluding a little bit to the concept of when Joshua made the sun stand still. Where God has control over the physical universe. So what's the context of this? When did these types of things get manifested? Well, look at verse 12. In indignation, you marched through the earth. In anger, you trampled the nations. You went forth for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your Messiah, your anointed. You struck the head of the house of evil to lay him open from thigh to neck. You pierced him with his own spears, the head of his throngs. They stormed in to scatter us. Their exultation was like those who devour the oppressed in secret. You trampled on the sea with your horses, on the surge of many waters. Remember how I mentioned a while back that in the Old Testament, a lot of times, the entire scope of redemption is mentioned as a single act. From the crucifixion, resurrection, and victory of Christ, and the second coming and the ultimate defeat of evil. That's found in Joel chapter 2 and 3 very clearly. He goes through the whole process as if it's one event. Here's another aspect of that. What we see is a trampling of the nations. Now, when we get to the New Testament, that becomes clear in two ways. Number one, the first horse is white. He's going forth with a crown, with a bow, and going to conquer. That is, I think, and we'll get there, we're going to go into the actual four horses next week and exactly what they all mean. But that seems to me to be the conquering of the gospel through the church age. Because the crown that he has is not the final crown. It's the crown that we have, the victory that Jesus had over death. That's the crown that we have. He gets another crown a little bit later on. That's a royal crown, and that's at the end, if I'm remembering my chronology right in Revelation. So this would indicate the risen Christ going forth conquering. But here's the thing. If the risen Christ goes and conquers the nations, what about those that don't obey or don't fall in line in that first attempt? Well, that's when they get trampled, is at the second coming. Either way, now think about this for a second. Either way, every single soul will be conquered. We either voluntarily submit to the lordship of Christ in this life, and he conquers us. We fall upon the cornerstone, and he breaks us into pieces. Or we resist, and then the cornerstone falls on us, and it scatters us like dust. Either way, every single person is conquered. And that's what Habakkuk chapter 3 is talking about. These chariots of salvation. And we'll get to the bow part later because that's an important piece. But in chapter 13, or sorry, in verse 13 and 14, he's talking about the destruction of Satan. Satan has been pierced through with his own spears. He has been laid open from thigh to neck. Now, if you think about the imagery there, that's pretty hardcore. He might be alive for a little bit, but he's writhing from a fatal blow that he will not recover from. That fatal blow was struck when Jesus Christ resurrected and ascended, and he was kicked out of heaven. In that battle, he was laid open. He still got a little bit of life left in him. He's still not to be messed with. But he has been defeated. The final defeat comes at the last time. So we see these passages, and we're going to see a couple of other ones next week, that intertwine all of these concepts, especially this concept of the bow. Because you think, what weapon comes to mind when you think of Christ in the church age? The sword. You don't normally think of a bow. That's steeped in Old Testament prophecy, which is really cool. You go back and you look at that and you think there's two really, really great messianic, this is one of them, two really great messianic prophecies that deal with the concept of a bow. The other one's Psalm 45, if you want to study ahead. It's just a really great comparison between the two. All right, I'm going to go ahead and actually stop there today. And we will pick back up, not next week, but the week after. We'll go through the individual four horsemen, what they mean, and how they all relate. Questions or comments as we wrap up?